Shane with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Today we continue with part two of Buried Alive, Torture in America, our seminal program about supermax prisons and also other forms of incarceration, how people are treated, the over 2 million people in prison and jails throughout the United States. First, we're going to a very brief update with Ralph Pointer about the case of Lynn Stewart.
And about the rally on Thursday.
Ralph? Yes, how are you, Maya?
How are you, Ralph?
You know, our hearts are in our throat. We're waiting for the resentencing of Lynn Stewart, and we're very upset that she was sentenced at all, that she was found guilty of terrorism by way of a press release and a prison regulation. We've lived 7 months of Lynn's incarceration in the prison system, her medical situation, being in the hospital, cuffed, handcuffed, and shackled, you know, while being there and dealing with this, and hoping to get some relief come next July 15th, when she is resentenced.
Ralph, Thursday, July 8th, 6 p.m., Judson Memorial Church, 55 Washington Square South. Speakers include our one and only Ralph Schoenman, yourself, Chairman Fred Hampton, Jr.,
yes,
Pam Africa from the Bobina case, many others.
On the issue of imprisonment and incarceration in general in America. As I was saying, that we're hoping that we get an improvement because although Lynn has, her liver has proved not to be cancerous, it was quite a scare for us. And we're hoping that she would get house arrest where she could go to the hospital and take care of the problems she had when she first went into the hospital. The event that you mentioned tomorrow is to help us, you know, like keep our spirits up. It is to help Lynn keep her spirits up. And also the 14th at Tom Paine Park, right down on Center and Worth, we're going to gather at 5:30 and have a little ceremony and then march three blocks to MCC and speak on Lynn's behalf for about 2 hours from 7 to 9:30 to lift up her spirits to be ready for the sentencing.
Great. Okay, all out Thursday, July 8th at 6 p.m., the Judson Memorial Church.
And remember, brothers and sisters, Lynn Stewart is being victimized because the government is involved in attacks upon the peoples of the world and the United States. 9/11, 1993, these are the government's actions for which they seek demons in order to create the architecture of the fascist state. Stand together, fight for Lynn, fight for ourselves, fight for the salvation of this society and for a fundamental change in its rule and its conduct.
See and now to Buried Alive, Part 2.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 13th, 2004. I have been a human rights advocate on behalf of prisoners in the United States for the past 26 years, writes Bonnie Kerness, coordinator of Prison Watch for the American Friends Service Committee. We dedicated our program, Buried Alive, Torture in America, Part 1, last week to Bonnie Kerness and to Tafalwa Balogun, a prisoner in the New Jersey system. This week, we continue with Torture in America. As Bonnie writes, those years, those 26 years, have brought hundreds of increasingly disturbing calls and complaints from U.S. prisoners and their families. Most describe inhumane conditions, including cold, filth, callous medical care, extended isolation sometimes lasting over a decade, harassment and brutality, vivid descriptions of four-point restraints, restraint hoods, restraint belts, restraint beds, stun grenades, stun guns, stun belts, tethers, waist and leg chains, and other devices of torture. Often prisoners report mentally ill prisoners banging their heads or screaming ceaselessly with no attention given to them other than overuse of psychotropic drugs. A social worker at Utah State Prison writes, Yoakum was directed to leave the strip cell, and a urine-soaked pillow was placed over his head like a hood. He was walked, shackled, and hooded to a different cell, where he was placed in a device called the chair. He was kept in the chair for over 30 hours, resulting in extreme physical and emotional suffering. Again from Utah, "I was sprayed," writes a prisoner, "with pepper spray, and it was 10 hours before I was allowed to wash. This resulted in burns and blisters to my arms, face, chest, and feet. For the entire 10 hours, I felt like I was being boiled alive. When you are forced to stand in the sun with no shelter, the sweat from your body continues to reactivate this chemical agent, so you remain in physical pain." Some of the most poignant letters, writes Bonnie, are on behalf of the mentally ill prisoners, like a man in California who spread feces over his body. The guard's response was to put him in a bath so hot it boiled 30% of the skin off his body. Or the letters I received on behalf of Frank Hunter, a mentally ill prisoner in a New Jersey isolation unit who was tortured to death. The guards would make Frank perform sexual acts on himself in order to get food or cigarettes. The use of extended isolation, which we discussed in great detail in Torture in America Part 1, has been a growing concern. In New Jersey, Ohori Lutalo has been held in the management control unit in total isolation since February 4, 1986. He never received any charges or explanation for this. Sensory deprivation, isolation, enough to drive people crazy. This is Torture in America. This and other brutality are at our discussion today.
One of the most extraordinary things about this material is that it is so elaborated, so extensive, so enormous in its reach across the United States in the prisons that populate our states from one end of this country to the other, that we're overwhelmed by the enormity of the material itself. We could spend the entire day just discussing the enormity of mental torture in lockdown. The restraints, as you indicate, the four-point chairs, the devil's chair, the torture and the experiments, the prison rape, the systematic violation of women and children. We have 2 hours to convey what would take months to communicate adequately, and here it is in the summary in the statement of Ohori Nurlutaro. How does one go about articulating desperation to another who is not desperate? How does one go about articulating the psychological stress of knowing that people are waiting for me to self-destruct? Picture living in a cage the size of your bathroom, tiers of single cages above and to either side. You remain in this cage 24 hours a day, day in and day out, year in and year out. As Bonnie Kernes writes, Rochelle McGee lived under these conditions in California for more than 20 years. Russell Schultz has been living in various Pennsylvania isolation units for 17 years. Ohori Lutaro in the Management Control Unit, MCU, in Trenton began his 13th year in extended isolation, has never been charged with an infraction. In 1972, the first official control unit was opened in Marion Federal Prison in Illinois as a behavior modification experimental unit. It was designed to torture people. It was intended to test the limits to which people could be subjected before breakdown occurred. It was nothing other than an experiment in torture, which has now become the systematic and systematized method of imprisoning people in this country. Sensory deprivation as a form of behavior modification was used in particular for political prisoners. It was begun with the Black Panther Party members, the Black Liberation Army formations, the American Indian Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. It was designed for activists, jailhouse lawyers, Islamic militants, prison activists. At one time or another, they have all found themselves living in extended isolation for years on end. Political prisoners still live in isolation, not because they've received a single charge or infraction, but because of who they are. and what they believe. As Bonnie Kernes explains, the experiment, so-called, in solitary confinement is expanded throughout this country through the Supermax prisons, the entire prisons that force people to live in this complete isolation for years and decades. You do not see or hear another human being. The fastest growing population living in enforced solitude is youth of color, imprisoned as the result of racist laws. These youngsters receive long, unconscionable sentences, and they are then led into this supermax prison system of sensory deprivation for years and even decades.
An important article appeared in the National Catholic Reporter by Claire Schaefer Duffy, December 8, 2000. She cites Chase Rivland, former director of two state departments of correction. He wrote an overview of supermax confinement for the National Institute of Corrections, and he noted that in Texas and California, where the inmate population is 150,000 per state, 7% of the incarcerated are in administrative segregation. He states specifically, quote, if you are in some parts of Texas and you have a Spanish surname, you are going to be locked down. In May 1999, the Village Voice reported that on any given day in New York State, 4,000 of the state's 71,000 prisoners were doing time in a segregated housing unit. You can be accused, but not even convicted, and still find yourself in permanent solitary lockdown. One of the most well-known in this category, notes the National Catholic Reporter, was Wen-Hung Lee. Lee, who had been accused of mishandling nuclear secrets, was kept in almost total isolation for 9 months when all but one of his 59 charges were dropped. Let's look at Pelican Bay State Prison in California. Pelican Bay, sprawled over 275 acres just south of the Oregon border, in a Tolkien-esque region of misty mountains and ancient redwood forests. But deep in Pelican Bay, deep in this prison that holds 1,200 prisoners, there is a security housing unit where there are no jobs, no activities, hardly any educational programs, and barely any human contact. As written by Vince Beisler in a special to the Times, October 19, 2003, quote, you are locked in your 8-by-10-foot cell almost around the clock. You can't see the other prisoners in the cell adjoining yours, nor the guards watching from a central observation booth. Most of the time, all you can see through the fingertip-sized perforations in your cell's solid steel door is the wall of the 8-cell pod, the larger cage containing your cage. Once a day, the remote-controlled cell door grinds open, and you get 90 minutes to spend alone in a walled-in courtyard, a place more like the bottom of a mine shaft than an exercise yard. It's an environment almost as restrictive and monotonous as human minds can design, and perhaps as human minds can tolerate.
Torture in Our Midst is the description and the title of the study by Bernice Powell Johnson on June 5th of 2000 of what are called special housing units. And what we have to note here is that the supermax prison and the control units and the administrative segregation, these are variations on a theme in every permutation and form, isolation and mental destruction through torture of this nature has been the norm and the resort to which prison authorities reach for their prison and population. As Bernice Powell Jackson describes it, 24,400 inmates across the U.S. officially, with many more multiples unofficially, locked down 23 hours a day for years. Life in SHUs is nothing like any of us can imagine. The cells, 7 feet by 8 feet, contain a bed, a sink, a toilet, and she describes what we have been recounting, if anything more gruesome. The prisoner never sees another human being. The guards control how long lights are on through video cameras, and microphones monitor every move and every physical response. state and federal courts have upheld the constitutionality of these prison units. Amnesty International have called it cruel and unusual punishment. Angela Wright, an Amnesty official, says this falls explicitly under the international standard of torture. Even former prison officials, as you cited, Chase Rivlin, former secretary of the Washington State Department of Corrections, have stated, "You put these young men, overwhelmingly black and Hispanic, into these conditions in solitary. Any rehabilitation, even survival, is hopeless." They are regressing. They are regressing into subhuman conditions without any human contact. We're turning these people into zombies.
Let's look at how people survive this numbing isolation. Or as Stuart Grassian, the renowned psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School who has studied the conditions of supermax prisons, said, the absolute total monotony, absolutely nothing coming in from the outside. What happens is psychological disintegration.
Let me just make this point, because before we discuss survival, let's be clear about what we're describing here. It's not only Stuart Grassian, but as the reports by Human Rights Watch establish, it is designed to, quote, manufacture madness. It is well established. This magnitude of isolation and sensory deprivation cause a variety of psychiatric symptoms and physiological and mental breakdown. Prolonged isolation brings about depression, despair, anxiety, rage, claustrophobia, hallucinations, problems with impulse control, and a total breakdown of the ability to think, concentrate, or remember. These conditions are designed for mental breakdown. They are designed for psychic torture. They are unspeakable in their degree, their extent, and their non-ending, decades-long subjugation of people to the total despair of such living conditions.
Let's look at how people survive. This is a manual produced by the American Friends Service Committee in November 1997. It's a manual written by and for people living in control units, and it is a testament to their willpower, their strength, and their perseverance. Paul Redd writes, "I now have been in prison 20 years, and 18 of them have been spent in various SHUs, the security housing units, from DVI, Folsom State Prison, San Quentin, and then to more high-tech isolation chambers at Corcoran State Prison and Pelican State Prison since 1990. I have many years of experience in these hellholes and have witnessed a great deal in terms of seeing individuals giving up their inner strength and beliefs because in their minds they could no longer deal with mental torture, isolation, the materialistic restrictions. These individuals gave up and broke themselves because they were missing the key essentials to their inner consciousness that give them the power to survive isolation. I have been asked over the years, how have you been able to survive all this and still be mentally intact? Before I begin sharing what I feel on some valid key points on how to survive the isolation in these dungeons, death traps, hell holes, let me state, these holes were purposefully designed as a torture chamber to break you mentally and physically into submission. Although these dungeons that our captives refer to as control units vary from state to state and prison to prison, some more isolated and restricted than others, their structure and use have the same malicious intent, and that is to control your existence and way of thinking. How do I survive? My answers are simple. 1. I know who I am and where I am going. 2. I don't let time do me, I do time. 3. My mind and thinking are far beyond the prison walls. And Paul Redd has some pointers. Among them, begin with studying your history, your culture. This will give you self-pride and respect. Think of ways that you can make positive contributions to our people. Write letters with your ideas. Keep writing. Don't stop. To family members, friends, churches, publications, radio DJs, college students, lawyers. Constantly writing reinforces your inner consciousness. Your focus is no longer your immediate isolation. Ralph?
The condition that we are describing here, that people are struggling to survive, does not only entail mental destruction. strokes, peptic ulcers, diabetes, hypertension, salmonellosis, stomach cancer, colon cancer, kidney disease, hemorrhoids, illnesses are brought on not only by lack of diet, but by the stress and the psychic destruction of the system. Stomach cancer, colon cancer, kidney disease, these things are a constant. And so it's a question of physical, no less than it is one of mental survival, to keep oneself mentally and physically healthy through these periods of endless isolation has been a challenge for myself, as I know it has for others, writes D.A. Sheldon in Iowa. Though I am one of those rare persons who has beaten the million-to-one odds, keeping myself extremely active, occupying loads of free time with a daily crammed schedule. I start with hour-long exercise regimen, push-ups, jumping jacks, running in place, crunches, pull-ups, chin-ups, stretching each muscle group. The most unique way I have discovered to keep the upper body in shape is by taking a pillowcase and filling it with heavy books and personal legal documents, and using the open end of the pillowcase as a handle to lift the one-half to three-quarter filled bag four different ways, lifting with each arm, then both arms in the front of the body, behind, right above the shoulder blades. It is very important in a forced sedentary lifestyle not to linger in a bunk and to allow the destruction and the atrophy of muscles, the irregular heartbeats, the hypertension, the depressed immune system, the total atrophy of muscle groups. Even with my exercise, I am affected by these conditions after 6 years of isolation. The next thing I do is write. I draft up articles and essays, often in my mind, a poem to counter the hysteria which is dished out against the prisoner class. I talk about the conditions within Americans' dungeons, the impracticalities of the criminal so-called justice system. The activity alone takes up the majority of my time, and it brings public attention to repressive conditions here at the Iowa State Warehouse, the reality of the American prison system as a whole. I encourage you who are similarly situated, pick up an ink pen or a pencil if they're allowed. Make a habit of communicating your experience. Keep a journal, writing on anything available to you, skin or walls. I do it on a daily basis. Try to send letters to local newspapers if this is allowed. I keep a busy schedule, and I seek to help others with their legal cases. I try to write to people. I try to keep in communication with others. I keep logs, books, charts, memos, and most importantly, read, if you're allowed it, especially books which further one's knowledge. And the system for survival is one of occupation, purpose, clarity about who one is, and will above all.
These are the writings of prisoners who have survived tens of years in supermax prisons, in isolation, in the hole, in security housing units of whatever name, whether it's management control or administrative segregation or the long-term supermax conditions. The Survivor's Manual from the American Friends Service Committee. Beyond isolation, there are so many other means of torture within the prison system. According to the United Nations, in its first Congress on the Prevention of Crime and the Treatment of Prisoners, August 30, 1955, conventions were established. They're called the Standard Minimum Rules for Treatment of Prisoners. And among them is one regarding excessive use of restraints. Quote, "Instruments of restraint, such as handcuffs, chains, irons, and straitjacket, shall never be applied as punishment. Furthermore, chains or irons shall not be used as restraint." These are the minimum standards, the rules adopted in 1955. And yet, if you look at torture in U.S. prisons, evidence of U.S. human rights violations, written by Bonnie Kerness and Masai Ehosi, and you look at the chapter on excessive use of restraints, you see over and again that the standard minimum rules are nothing but a piece of paper. Yashua M. from Northern Prison, Summers, Connecticut, on January 23, 1998, as well as on January 18th and in other undated letters to the American Friends Service Committee, wrote, "In 1994, I was maced and chained because I refused to go to court without a hot meal. As a result, he was maced, he was chained, and he writes that he knows of prisoners who are deceased as a result of being forced to cuff while having severe asthma attacks. One of these prisoners died November 3, 1997. Randy A. in Pelican Bay Prison, Crescent City, California, May 10, 1998, wrote, I was repeatedly a victim of the stun belt, waist chains, and leg chains. One was placed around my neck and wrapped twice, and the loose ends of the neck chain were secured to my waist chains by small padlocks. I was then made to kneel down, and a second chain was looped around my ankle chains and secured to my waist chains by small padlocks. All this was done during court dates in holding cell areas.
The conditions you're describing with restraint are generalized. There isn't a prison. There isn't a holding pen. There isn't an arraignment arena in county jail before people have even been sentenced in which these techniques of restraint are not ubiquitously employed. Kevin Jay in the Northern Correctional Institute in Somers, Connecticut, I have been injured multiple times, scarring, nerve problems, shoulder pain from falls. I am kept chained hand and foot, in and between and from behind, while placed outside in the courtyard by myself for hours. All this deliberate and designed to create injury.
In Allred Unit, Texas, Jerry M. and James V. wrote in early 1998, I was chained to a bed sitting up for 21 days, fed one sandwich three times a day and one cup of water. I had refused to go in lockup. Guards jumped on me, grabbed me by the balls, and in a chokehold. Or Norwood N., after serving a sentence in Rahway, New Jersey, wrote in 2000 about transport. He put my hands one over the other, palms down, referring to what was done by the guard. Then he put the cuffs on me, one over the other. Then he put my arms up at chest level, almost under my chin. He put a so-called Chinese box device that goes between the cuffs and prevents any movement. He then took a heavy, large-link chain and passed it around me, almost at armpit level. I had to hold my arms up so high and avoid any wrist movement or the cuffs cut into my wrist hard. The leg irons were put on, so there was no slack to let them swivel when I walked. That's how I was required to walk and move during transport. My wrists were bloodied by the time I got to the facility.
And Maya, this is a condition which is inflicted on people during prison visits with family or even with lawyers when they are rarely allowed. John Doe T., Ohio State, on January 20th, 1999, visiting here is a punishment. The prisoner is chained to spine-stressing immobilities with arms locked in unnatural angles, forced to sit on a steel stool with no back support. It is painful. And for that reason, I have asked family to stop visiting. We are made to sit on stool without the ability to gesture with hands in conversations. Our arms and hands are twisted. And Jason in Ohio State Penitentiary states, they have a stool on one side of the petition like the ones we sit on. There is a chain that is bolted to the floor. They sit you down on the stool, handcuffed behind your back, and then another pair of handcuffs and locks the prisoner's handcuffs and the other to the chain. It is so painful on shoulders and arms and backs you cannot move or you will dislocate or break your wrists and shoulders. They use this chair for hearings and consultations. I saw a committee to be released from Ohio State Prison Penitentiary. I was chained to the stool. My arms fell asleep in 5 minutes.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
And then there's the phenomenon known as the four-point restraint, ubiquitously used.
For the four-point restraint, let us look again at the UN Convention, the Mini-Rule, Part 1, Items 12, 13, and 15, which state that the sanitary installations shall be adequate to enable every prisoner to comply with the needs of nature when necessary and in a clean and decent manner. Adequate bathing and shower installations shall be provided so that every prisoner may be enabled and required to have a bath or shower at least once a week. Prisoners shall be required to keep their persons clean and thus be provided with water and such toilet facilities as are necessary for health and cleanliness. Yet, with a four-point restraint, a prisoner is strapped down by the ankles and wrists, either to a bed or to a bare table.
Maya, quite frankly, these injunctions about torture written by Amnesty, written by the United Nations, written by international conventions. They might as well be put on porous paper for all the application they have. Here is the actual reality. CINQ, Utah Maximum Security, basically the board, is a piece of board 3 feet wide and 6 feet long. The prisoner is stripped and shackled, spread-eagled on the board. The board is inclined from the wall. A guard comes in with chow and a bedpan. If you have to use the bathroom, you must do it in the bedpan. You are never unshackled. The guard holds the pan under you. They give you Ensure, which is a protein drink, so you don't eat solid food. Doc S. in the Red Onion State Prison in Wise County, Virginia. And by the way, let us say about the conditions in Virginia with their supermax and their torture instruments and their constant lockdown. The latest in the methods of torture, Doc S. writes, allows nursing staff to order the use of four-point restraints for prisoners. They are constantly accused of masturbating in view of female staff, an unlikely condition that never occurs. These are false claims, and they are deployed to enable them to strap down prisoners who they dislike or any prisoner who they feel they want to punish, 24 hours at a time, in four-point strap-down. Others are put down for 72 hours. There is a new twist to how the 4 points are applied. Normally, a man is strapped at his ankles and his wrists with his arms down at his side. Now the man's arms are placed above his head. He is strapped to the four corners on a bare board in boxer shorts. He is led up at 8 a.m., 12 noon, at 4 p.m. Then he is restrapped. By 1 a.m., a man has already soiled himself. Prisoners vomit while on their backs. Log copies and medical records relating to the period of restraint are no longer maintained. In apparent anticipation of the influx of prisoners to be strapped down, extra cells have had to be set up and converted into strap-down cells across the prison. I was in the shower when a guy was led up from the restraint so he could take a 2-minute shower because he had soiled himself. The jackbooted thugs made the guy carry his piss-soaked boxers while handcuffed, and then the thug guard said, "We don't give out new boxers because you pissed in them." Then the dude came up and went into the regular cell, and the piss-stinking boxers were placed over his head. Mike C., USP, Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Four-pointed with steel handcuffs, steel leg irons for 70 hours, chained up with those and a belly chain. The warden stared at the outset and then walked off. Alan Q., USP, Lexington, Kentucky. I have been four-pointed multiple times, left in progressive restraints, shackles, belly chain, handcuffs for over 5 days, defecating upon myself, pissing all over myself, left in that condition.
Yashua M. from Northern Prison, Summers, Connecticut, wrote to the American Friends Service Committee that the use of four-point is something that they use to break slaves. They chained me butt naked to a metal bed, cold air blowing on me, no heat in the cell for more than 8 hours. And then a female officer kept coming to the door every 15 minutes to gawk at me. But Dan H. from MCF, Oak Park Heights Prison in Stillwater, Minnesota, reports something harrowing about what was done to a prisoner in December of 1998. When they placed this prisoner, who was 47 years old, on a four-point restraint board, after a sergeant set him up and stepped on his foot while the prisoner was chained to the steel loop embedded in the bed so he wasn't able to resist. When he pulled away in pain, the officers from the squad began beating him repeatedly and sadistically with knee blows to his thighs and arms. They used pressure point holds to torture the prisoner. He was not resisting. Then they put him on the board face down and placed what appeared to be a golf ball under his left breast, and those 240-pound squad guys put their weight and knees into his back, pressing his breastbones and ribs down upon the board, causing him to scream in terror and agony. 5 months later, I saw this prisoner again, and he still had the bruises under his breastbone. And then Dan H., writing about himself, said that eventually he was placed on the board and four-pointed. The guard said he was suicidal. However, this was a lie, as he would never threaten himself. and I never said I would. I was assaulted by the staff, placed on the board with the straps used to hold me down. I could hardly breathe. I have asthma. I lost all feeling in my feet and arms. I panicked. I summoned for help. I thought I would die. There was a review of the film. This was actually filmed. And the supervisor said there was nothing wrong.
Charlie S., the federal prisoner in Jackson, Michigan, describes the chair to which he was subjected repeatedly. A hard plastic restraining device in the form of a chair built on a steel frame with two wheels, so when tilted back it can be rolled. The front legs are steel, have two nylon straps on each leg to immobilize the legs. The seat of the chair is higher in the front than the back, causing you to slip back into the seat area. The seat is solid form molding, causing the weight to jam the raised molding into pressure points like the sciatic nerve and the coccyx bone. The back of the chair has raised molding to press on the kidneys and the spine between the shoulder blades. To ensure this pressure, there are two nylon straps that crisscross the chest. The third chest strap is placed directly across the upper rib cage to minimize breathing. A strap is placed directly across the foreheads. Then the guards place a hood over the person's head. The straps are placed in such manner as to cause broken bones and permanent nerve damage. Prisoners, once in the chair, we can remain that way for indefinite periods, hours, even days, 17 hours at a time. The straps cause prisoners to urinate and defecate, in addition to the lumps and the molding pressing on nerves and spinal cord. A 17-year-old boy died in the chair, killed by guards using the chair on 12-17-98 at Pueblo Jail. I saw them kill him. I was unable to help him. I was interviewed by a journalist from the Pueblo Chieftain at the jail concerning this murder. The reporter told me that the prisoner's murder had been ruled a heart attack. Between the last month of 1998 and the early months of 1999, I was in 15 different county jails, and I saw the chair used consistently in Arizona, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, and California.
The chair is used throughout the United States in county jails for people arrested, whether for drunkenness or for political activity. The chair is used in city prisons and counties. It's used by the Immigration Service. In an important article called The Devil's Chair by Anne Marie Cusack, who had been the managing editor of The Progressive, this article is available on www.angelfire.com, where you'll find many articles about prison conditions. It's called the Strapa Lounger, the Barca Lounger, the We Care Chair, the B-Suite Chair, but inmates and their lawyers have other names for the devices, the Torture Chair, the Slave Chair, and the Devil's Chair. The chair is manufactured by KLK, which sells it for $2,290 plus a $190 crating charge. That's KLK of Phoenix, Arizona. They call it the Violent Person Restraint Chair. And also by AEDEC International, Beaverton, Oregon, which manufactures the Prostraint Violent Prisoner Chair. And they sell this throughout the United States. Theirs costs $1,300 with the accessories. It's recommended for, quote, interrogating prisoners, detaining people in holding tanks in mass entertainment facilities such as concert halls and coliseums, for intake and booking sections of local jails, and by the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
And Maya, the report by Anna Marie Cusack establishes the following. Restraint chairs are used for punishment of non-threatening behavior. Children are strapped to chairs for non-violent behaviors. Nude inmates and detainees strapped into the chairs. Prisoners left in these chairs for 8 days at a time. Prisoners required to testify while in these restraint chairs. Prisoners interrogated while in restraint chairs. Prisoners injured and dying in these chairs. Tortured by being hooded, pepper gas, beaten, and threatened with electrocution while in the chair. The use of the restraint chair is widespread. Jails, state and federal prisons, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the U.S. Marshals Service, state mental hospitals, juvenile detention centers, all equipped with the chair. Amnesty International has called for a federal investigation into the use of the restraint chair. This device is of the greatest concern to us, said Angela Wright at Amnesty headquarters in London. It is used as frontline and routine form of control and for punishing any prisoner and any detainee. On December 20, 1994, Shedrick Brown died while being forced into a restraint chair in the Hillsborough County Jail in Tampa, Florida. After 4 hours, he was found unresponsive, having suffered a stroke. On April 17, 1995, Carmelo Morello died in the Sacramento County Jail, strapped to a restraint chair. The death was no accident. His death was listed as the result of acute cardiac arrhythmia due to hypoxemia from combined restraint, asphyxia, and severe physical exertion due to an apparent psychotic episode. As Supervising Deputy Coroner Phil Elbert explained to the Sacramento Bee, restraint asphyxia is a lack of oxygen caused by a highly agitated state exacerbated by extreme restraint. Scott Norborg died in June 1996 in Arizona of what the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office called positional asphyxia. Pushed into a restraint chair, his head forced to his chest, and then shocked with a stun gun and gagged. Caitlin Zentau, a journalist, died in late 1996 at the Connecticut Valley Hospital, according to an investigative report that appeared in the Hartford Courant. For 33 hours, Zentau was strapped into a restraint chair. She died after being released from the chair from blood clots that had traveled to her lungs. On and on and on. Michael Valent died after spending 16 hours in the restraint chair in Utah prison in March 1997. The deputy chief medical examiner confirmed that the prolonged restraint was the precipitating factor leading to blood clots and instant death. Daniel Sagers in Osceola County, Florida jail, after guards placed him in a restraint chair and beat him using a towel to force his head back so violently that they damaged his brain stem. 18 pages, single-spaced, this one study, The Devil's Chair, replete with citations from county jails, state institutions, federal institutions, interrogation centers, detention centers from one end of this country to the other.
What is remarkable about these 18 pages is that these are the result of lawsuits, successful lawsuits, against counties, against cities, and against prisons for their holding facilities. Successful lawsuits where cities and counties and states have paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to prisoners for this torture. And yet, this is the prevalent mode used by prisons, by county jails, by interrogation centers at the city, county, state, and federal level throughout the United States. Particularly, this form of torture is used against the mentally ill in prisons. As Human Rights Watch stated in an important report, a 215-page report, Ill-Equipped U.S. Prisons and Offenders with Mental Illness, published in 2003, 1 in 6 U.S. prisoners is mentally ill. 70,000 on any given day have a psychotic episode. Many of them suffer from serious illness such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. There are 3 times as many men and women with mental illness in U.S. prisons as in mental health hospitals. The rate of mental illness in the prison population is 3 times higher than the general population. And as Human Rights Watch notes, state and local governments have shut down mental health hospitals across the United States and have failed to provide adequate alternatives. Many people with what's termed mental illness, particularly those who are poor, homeless, or struggling with substance abuse problems, cannot get treatment if they commit a crime, even low-level, nonviolent offenses. Punitive sentencing laws mandate imprisonment. As Human Rights Watch states, unless you are wealthy, it can be next to impossible to receive mental health services in the community. Many prisoners might never have ended up behind bars if publicly funded treatment had been available. And let's look at some of this treatment. Mentally ill prisoners are locked in segregation, confined in filthy and beastly hot cells, left for days covered in feces they have smeared over their bodies, taunted, abused, or ignored by prison staff, given so little water during summer heat waves that they drink from their toilet bowls. A prison expert recently described one prison unit as, quote, medieval, cramped, unventilated, unsanitary. It will make some men mad and mad men madder. Suicidal prisoners are left naked and unattended for days on end in barren, cold observation cells. This is a 215-page report that was published by Human Rights Watch in October of 2003. This is not times past. This is the living reality in prisons across the United States today.
Let me cite here a normal and standardized and accepted treatment of prisoners called the shackle. And in this study by Angel Fire, the following is revealed. Shackles cause disease. The great majority of men and women entering prisons test negative for hepatitis C. After incarceration, the test comes back positive with hepatitis 60% of the time. In the solitary confinement units, 87% test positive for hepatitis C. These are the results of being shackled, ankles and wrists. And the reason? The shackles are contaminated with viruses from previous use. The shackles create extreme abrasions and create entrance portals for the viruses. There are no biohazard precautions taken into these units, and the virus spreads routinely. The men are rotated in the cells endlessly. There is human waste on the walls and floors of the cell, and blood. The cells and units are covered in feces, urine, and blood. 60% hepatitis C, when there is no hepatitis C on entry of prison. 87% testing positive after being subjected to shackles. The very condition of prison is a torment in the United States. Torture aside, isolation aside, brutality aside, electrical devices aside, torment, torture, systemic disease is the designed result of incarceration in this country.
Human Rights Watch, Doing Something About Prison Rape, by Laura Semple, Wendy Patton, and Benjamin Jealous. 1 in 5 male inmates in the United States has faced forced or pressured sexual contact in custody, according to studies on the subject by researchers such as Cindy Struckman Johnson at the University of South Dakota. 1 in 10 has been raped. For women, whose abusers are often corrections officers, the rates of sexual assault are as high as 1 in 4 in some facilities. Rodney Hewlin didn't deserve what happened to him, writes Human Rights Watch. Rodney was only 16 years old and small for his age when he committed a minor crime, setting a dumpster on fire in an alley. He was charged with arson. He was sentenced to an adult prison where he was repeatedly raped and sexually assaulted. Officials ignored his written pleas for help. The prison staff brushed off his mother's attempts to protect her child. Unable to endure a life of constant torture, Rodney hanged himself in January 1996, 70 days after entering prison. The victims of rape behind bars are beaten, bloodied, and even dead. They have contracted sexually transmissible disease such as HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis A and B. They have suffered from crippling depression, substance abuse, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Rape in prison. 1 in 5 males, 1 in 4 women. The Washington College of Law at American University in 1999 reported with respect to women that sex involved not just correctional officers, it involved chaplains, administration, deputy wardens, contractors, and food service workers. It involved not just male staff, but female staff as well. Studies by Amnesty International, studies by Human Rights Watch, studies for class action suits, such as one in Georgia in 1992, and another that was settled in 1998 that involved California, the one in California, Lucas versus White, the one in Georgia, Kaysen versus Seclinger, all documented heavily the sexual abuse of women. A 347-page report by Human Rights Watch in 1996 entitled All Too Familiar, Sexual Abuse of Women in U.S. Prisons, cited California, Washington, D.C., Michigan, Georgia, and New York State, where male correctional employees vaginally, anally, and orally raped female prisoners and sexually assaulted and abused them as commonplace.
They found that in the course of committing these acts, the officers not only used actual and threatened physical force, but used their total authority to provide or deny any privileges to female prisoners, to compel them to have sex, or to reward them briefly for doing so. Women in prison, Judy V., Edna Mahon Correctional Facility in Clinton, New Jersey. For over 2 years, I have been sexually abused by male prison guards and male civilian personnel at this institution. The condition is generalized, as the report describes. Women in prison and the perpetual use of rape and abuse is only the little beginning. Child abuse is as ubiquitous and as barbarous and brutal.
As Bonnie Kernes concluded in the spring of 1999 in her seminal piece, Torture and Slavery in U.S. Prisons, A Violation of International Human Rights, it pains me to say that the U.S. uses devices of torture with impunity.
One last word. The prison industry, capitalist punishment by Julie Light and Corporate Watch on October 28, 1999, what we have described here today, is the little continuation of class war, the victimization of the poor, the criminalization of poverty, the privatization of prisons, the profits for the few, and the generalized pump-priming device of sending prisons across this country to create jobs for guards and for the suppression of the underclass. It is torture. It is the class war. It is capitalist America. It is the system that sustains this barbarous treatment of human beings in our society.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Buried Alive, Torture in America.